define stewardship in different ways. And the intent was to fill us full of all of that, put us all in one room, and then do some work to begin to list out what we believe are those best practices based on that large body of work that's been done to date. And we also fully recognize that there's more work than what we heard yesterday and what we'll hear today that's out there. But this is a good start. It's a way of kind of, I think, getting a good jump start on this particular task. And so today we're going to hear a little bit more information, particularly related to the National Environmental Literacy Assessment work that's been done, which I think can help us in both thinking about a framework for this moving forward and also about a large body of work that will continue to move forward that will certainly help and complement a lot of what we're doing in this region. And then we're going to work. And we're going to actually try to distill what we've heard and begin to list a set of best practices. And the groups will stay as they were. As you know, we've sort of formed amoebas among each of the student group and the teacher group. And so you're going to work more as a whole group to begin to, in the case of the students, you know, kind of crosswalk the MeWe definition to things that you heard yesterday, in addition to new things, teachers building a list of best practices based on what we heard, and similar for schools. The products will be very draft lists of those best practices, right? And in the afternoon, with that discussion fresh in our minds, we're going to then have another working session to essentially brainstorm what would be some potential indicators and or metrics that would be practical proxies to sort of tracking student stewardship over time. So those are the kind of two working sessions. Those are the two products. And those are just draft lists at this point. They will have no, I don't think, any expectation for being, you know, close to final or even having any implications beyond today at that point. But they will feed what will then begin a process that will be largely led by the education work group of the Chesapeake Bay program. Many of us here are members of that group, but will certainly reach out and engage a much broader set of stakeholders, including those from the EE community. I'm sure anyone interested in staying involved from the research and evaluation community, as well as the agencies and the school systems that have been partners to date. That process will begin to look at how to update the definition of the meaningful watershed education experience that we heard a lot about yesterday, to incorporate things that we sort of learned from this session. We'll also be using this, to be quite honest, and Kevin, you know, I think rightfully reminded me of this, is that, you know, the NOAA BWET program and the Chesapeake Bay Trust funding programs have both really aligned themselves pretty closely with what has been the current definition of a meaningful watershed education experience, which embodies a series of best practices that were known to date. And that will likely continue. So there's no question that one of the uses of this information that will come out in whatever shape or form it takes will inform the way that we as funders of environmental education will probably begin to shape and prioritize the programs we support, which we hopefully will continue to support ongoing and have really helped, I think, support hundreds of great experiences for kids out there. And then also, we think that this will inform, we hope, a much, hopefully, ongoing and fairly significant set of strategies that will be designed to help provide assistance to all of the folks, both in the formal and informal side of environmental education, in program development, in self-evaluation of their programs, and in establishing, you know, evaluation plans themselves, and thinking about how they're actually tracking and measuring the impact of the programs that do. That work, we're not quite sure exactly how to envision that yet, but we're certain that we want to pursue it at some point after this session. So that's just a quick revisit on our task and where that task will go eventually. So any questions about that, or more importantly, any reactions from yesterday that you just wanted to share with the group that would be good for us to consider moving forward? Go ahead.
Can I just make a recommendation? In this discussion, it's really been hard to hear in a small table. Is there any way?
I can give you a direct answer to that. this group, when we do break for the working sessions, is going to meet downstairs.
Right. Oh, okay, thank you.
So we'll lose about half of the group. Hopefully that'll lower the decibel level and make it easier for us to work. All right, that was me.
One of the things, actually, Elaine and I were talking about this morning was that this potential applications, the updated, broadened MeWe definition and tracking methods, it seemed like looking at some of the research from yesterday that a lot of the research like started off with this, we are looking if these three things happen. You know, are we going to get that specific? Could we get that specific? Could we say the end result of MeWe's are that we expect X and have it just be pretty simple, not a longer, broader definition, because a MeWe could be a very broad definition, but the end result of a MeWe is that we have students who are empowered. You know, like if we just have a very simple end result, or maybe a three end result, are we going to work towards that? Or
I think we could. I mean, I think that's up for discussion.
Okay.
I mean, in terms of how that definition would be structured, and what would be the content versus what would be the stated outcome, you know, that would result. I mean, all of that, I think, is up for discussion, in particular after this session, right, when we get down into the weeds of actually what is this draft going to look like? And I was going to hold up a copy of the old version.
It's right here.
With the current version.
Right there where it says stewardship. Yeah.
And I think these are on your... These are on your table.
You can pick anything.
Sorry. It's only one of three, so, you know, eventually. So, I mean, this was what was the definition. You know, it looks, you know, very official and very long and very dense, right?
Yeah. Right,
and
right.
Has this been as useful as it needs to have been for those folks who provide these? I don't know. I mean,
well,
there's lots of folks who have produced guides and have built off of this to make things that are more applicable. So.
Well, it's not just a guide, but I'm thinking if we hope to measure it, then it should be, then we should have an outcome that we hope to measure. So am I beating a dead horse? But I just, I don't know. That's just what I was thinking from yesterday.
Good suggestion.
So I'm struggling a little bit. I can see that the focus is formal education here. So we're interested in students, teachers, and school audiences. And yet we're interested in student stewardship, which I'm not exactly sure what that is. I guess one question, are we interested in what students are doing at school in terms of stewardship? Are we interested in what students are doing in their lives as stewardship? I suspect it's the latter. If it is the latter, then it seems very narrowed to think that we can just address what happens in school and then have that apply to their lives. So, especially given some of what we talked about yesterday. So, I guess I'm just struggling a little bit with number one, is best practices to do in school, to number two, impact what happens partly in school, but also a lot of life occurs outside of school. So maybe you could clarify, is the stewardship specifically the school? If it's not specifically the school, is there some way we can take in a larger context?
Shannon wants to respond.
What comes to mind is kind of the work that the bills that I've described now, the National Environmental Literacy Assessment, and that's really looking at the holistic kind of where students are in their environmental literacy effort and why we're not proposing to do that. That's why we're not doing tests for students and really figuring out where they are. What we have come up with as a proxy for how schools are influencing that is best practices. And we want to measure the implementation of these best practices because the research shows that those things influence their stewardship. So we don't want to get down, we're not going to be measuring. And that's why what Karen was saying earlier is going to be hard, because we're not going to be measuring where kids are in their literacy. That's not something that we can do as a community. We're going to be looking at implementation of best practices that all the research shows.
Well, that's straightforward. And what are the best practices, and are they being implemented?
That's what we're right. We're talking about.
Okay. That's pretty easy.
When we get to the metrics part, that's
yeah,
exactly.
Indicators.
Yep, that's easy.
It's easier.
I'm confused because maybe you're talking about two different things. Implementation of best practices in the classroom is one thing, and not easy to measure, but easier. Indicators measuring student stewardship, that's something else. That's what number two says.
We're looking at best practices that influence student stewardship. So we are looking at the still tracking widgets of who's getting the best practices.
Well, there's a little bit of gray area there. And the reason why we state stewardship is because in the best practices discussion, we're trying to surface those best practices that are linked with, making some change in student stewardship levels. And you could, depending on what program, you might be focused on character development, academic achievement, or any number of other outcomes, which are all important, and we agree with all of those. But for the purposes of this discussion, we're focused on those student stewardship outcomes. Right? And so that's why it's important. Piece to just keep in mind as we begin to think about best practices.
So,
and then this afternoon when we get to the metrics piece and the tracking piece, it's sort of what are those interim measures, for lack of a better word, before you get to measuring those outcomes, which we'll hear about, which are hard to measure, that we could use that could be tied to those best practices or in some other way related to those best practices, that if we were able to identify those, then we'd have some reasonable hope that the students that were exposed to those best practices would be demonstrating increased stewardship.
Maybe that's the issue I'm trying to, where the steps are missing. So there's what you do in the PD. There's whether that influences at least the changes in teaching practices. Then there's a whole big other step, which how that affects students in the classroom.
Right.
And then you've added a fourth level, which is does that affect what they do in their lives? And maybe it would be helpful to make sure that we're talking, what right. level we're talking about, because it's not fair to we're just going to talk about best practices, and we'll just, we'll say that's a proxy for what they're doing.
On the podium.
That's a big leap. You have to do it.
You're exactly right. And so... this is what my attempt to be like, we might be looking at things at all different stages, right? I mean, if you're exactly right. If there are best practices around teacher PD and it stops there and say, if these things happened in this professional development, that teacher's more likely to implement high quality EE, right? Whatever that is. That we may stop at some indicator, some metric there, right? Then it's another leap to say, but the students who were in the class with that teacher, I don't know how far we'll take them.
Right, and I think step with the teacher is a fine goal. I'm not suggesting that. I think that's a good place to start, but I just think be careful not... It's a huge leap from what to change
Absolutely.
Teaching practices in right. itself is huge, but then the step of the influence on the students is something that we may want to look at.
And I think that's a very good point. And I guess to me, what that says is that we're not going to be even making close to assumptions about student outcomes even at the end of the today or even in the future. And that is the kind of discussion that I think will be very important as we begin to finalize these in whatever shape, form they take. When we then say what would be reasonable to say as a result of collecting this information, what would be a reasonable statement that would be safe to essentially assume. And I don't think we have to really worry about that so much today, as much as we just need to think about what would be the important things that we could collect information about that in aggregate or in some combination would give us some better picture than what we have today.
And I think something to also make you feel better about the value of thinking about implementation very thoughtfully, because that's essentially what you're doing, is that this is a common thing that people do, is when they're focusing on learning outcomes, for example, somebody who doesn't do this every day, doesn't think that they also really have to capture implementation. They're just thinking of the outcomes. But there's no point to looking at outcomes if you're not looking at implementation, because if there were changes in learning, you would never know why. And so why did you do this to begin with? It's a waste of time. And so from an evaluation standpoint, you always want to know, why did the change occur or why did it not occur? So the reason it's very important to look at the implementation and really understand what it is you want to look at and how you want to look at it is because you have to do that anyways. There's no point to doing outcome anything without looking at implementation. So that should make you feel better.
Somehow I don't.
Sorry. I tried.
You know, when we think about the outcome to affect a change in a student, many of these students are not quite in the position to affect the change that we're wanting. And they may not be for 10 years, 5 years, depending on if we're talking about high school students or elementary students. Sometimes the effect is not going to happen until they are the consumer, the homeowner, the renter, the person who's buying the car. Is there any conversation at this time to possibly start collecting data on those kinds of people, you know, young people, the kind of education or programs that they've been involved in, to see what purchases are you making, what lifestyle choices are you making, what is the history of your environmental education that might be, it might not be the news story they're getting, it might not be the article in Newsweek or Time, it might be, I was involved in this in my classroom, the teacher had an influence on me, so now, you know, then I, well, you know, I could turn off my light in my home, you know, I could maybe walk, but I wasn't buying a car,
right.
And I wasn't insulating my house.
But the camera on the head of the kid, and, you know, watch everything that they do for 5 years after.
Well,
but no, I mean, I know what you're saying.
Longitudinal data, right. And I think that's really where we might get our best results.
Well, that is a great, I think, point to make and a great question to raise, and I'm going to defer that to when Bill McBeth gives his presentation on the National Environmental Because the reason why we're not proposing to do longitudinal studies with this work is because there is a large effort underway to look at what those changes are over time and to try to do it in such a way that creates what is a consistent measure of those things without having to go in. And not that it would, I'll let Bill answer this question.
I think if you take a look at where your state is, that gives you an indicator, some type of longitudinal indicator of how well your system, your environmental education systems have been working. You know, there are states that are way further behind than Maryland or Pennsylvania, right. Or, you know, and I think that is a direct impact on students' prior education and how they behave as adults. It's a difficult thing to do, difficult thing to measure, because how are you going to follow somebody around?
You're assuming that all of those students who've been educated have stayed in your state. In West Virginia, we have a lot of folks.
I'm not. I'm looking at the larger percentage. I'm not looking at the individual part. I'm looking at why the state has moved forward. Who are the players in the state? Doesn't mean other people can't come in, but one person can't. Well, that's not true. In Wisconsin, one person. It takes a group of people really to keep the momentum going in a direction such as I think it's gone in Maryland.
This is a great discussion. I'm going to just make the call that this will be exactly what we're going to talk about. And I think it's healthy, and that's exactly why we're here. Just to ask the hard questions, wrestle through them, and then figure out what it is that we might actually be able to do. So, any last general questions or thoughts? All right. So, I will turn it over to Peyton Robertson, who's the director of the NOAA office for the Chesapeake Bay here in Annapolis, and a tremendous supporter of all of this work. And I think We all owe him a debt of gratitude for helping keep the BWET program as strong and as vibrant as it is.
Thank you. Yeah. And thanks to you all. It's great to be here with you this morning. I'm your kickoff guy. So get ready. Here's the kickoff. I just want to make 3 points this morning. They go like this. One, it's personal. Two, why Noah? Why now? And the third is where to from here. And I love listening to this conversation that just went on in this room. In fact, I was thinking in response to the longitudinal data, ask, you know, just collect the data on yourselves. Why are you all here? What happened to you? Why did you end up choosing this kind of work? For me, that's the it's personal part. It's no coincidence, I think, that I'm standing in front of you. I had a lot of influences in my life that made a big difference, not least of which was getting my start with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, working for that guy over there with the slightly graying hair, and having a lot of meaningful, oh, those were meaningful watershed experiences, that's right. That's when we were working, right? But that certainly made a big difference, and there have been similar things like that. I participated in the Sea Semester program when I was a junior in college, and all those things really just, you know, made a big impact. So that's a little bit of an applause for what you do. The other personal thing is 2 blocks from here, my son is starting today his 8th grade year at the Bates Performing and Visual Arts Magnet School in Annapolis. And so I was thinking about what you were just saying about how do you see the outcomes. And I can tell you from observing my own child that the outcomes are extremely evident in terms of his happiness. So I was thinking that maybe, I was also reading an article about using MRIs to tell people are lying now. Which has not been demonstrated, but I thought maybe someday it will be brain chemistry. Maybe we'll be able to look at MRIs of students who've had meaningful watershed experiences to see whether their brain chemistry has literally been affected. I'm not kidding. This, you know, brain science and brain chemistry are quite fascinating subjects. So that kind of meaningful impact is evident to me, and it just is fabulous. The second point on why Noah and why now... you know, I think maybe it speaks for itself, maybe this is self-evident to you all, but NOAA is really the Whole Earth Agency, and a lot of people don't know that. Our previous administrator used to refer to us as the Rodney Dangerfield of federal agencies. And, you know, whether that's, I don't get no respect or nobody knows about us, neither of which is really the point. It's that think about Hurricane Isaac bearing down on New Orleans right now. Think about the meteorologists that are working around the clock looking at model outputs. Think of the information that was just released a few weeks ago from the National Climatic Data Center about warming Earth temperatures and the data records on temperature. Think about the expertise that's necessary to do those jobs. Think about the people we need to motivate not only to fill those seats, and that's when we often talk about it, NOAA, is, well, NOAA's got to find the next generation of scientists and kids who like science, technology, engineering, and math. But really, and this is back to your point about longitudinal data and affecting change, we've got to create a society that cares about these things, or NOAA will die. NOAA will not be an agency in the future because we won't have created a society that cares about the things that we're trying to make important to people's lives. Nothing like a hurricane bearing down to get people's attention. That tends to get people perked up. But I don't, again, don't need to tell you when you ask folks, well, you know, where does all that information come from to project the cone of likely strike? Oh, the Weather Channel. From the Weather Channel. Right. You know, keep in mind there's a supercomputer in West Virginia that is cranking, as well as a supercomputer close by, and all of that data from all the information that's collected out there in the world is fed through those models, is projecting exactly where the hurricane will go. So the level of expertise that will be necessary to fulfill that mission in the future will only increase. And what's really cool, and I heard a presentation at a summit last year about the new standards, is that this inquiry-based learning, to me, that just that term, or interdisciplinary, inquiry-based learning, is really what NOAA is all about. You talk to the people in our agency, and that's what inspires them. That's what they're looking at. There are these fascinating scientists that are looking at the data records and are writing articles about, you know, the changes that are occurring to our planet. Notwithstanding that fascination, they're not always the best public speakers, and they're not always the best translators. So we have work to do to create this knowledge base in society about what the issues are that we're dealing with and why it matters. My third point, where to from here, is really for you, and that is first to acknowledge that the Scientific and Technical Advisory Committee, the Chesapeake Bay Program, to sponsor this meeting, I think is fabulous. I really want to acknowledge Jamie and Shannon and Kevin and all the colleagues that have worked together to make this particular workshop come off. But I think this is a great example of getting advice and counsel from experts around the nation. And at the rooftop bar last night, all of you were talking about how exciting it was and all the great people that are here and everybody, you know, the best minds are here. And so my advocacy for you in light of that is that this advice and this best practice and the kind of outline that you're doing, that you really use it. I mean, I'm just kind of telling you what you would expect in sort of a classic teacher experiential context, which is, please, students, when you're done today, when you've finished writing down those best practices, get out there and use them. Commit to some action. Come back with these best practices. And while the path is not necessarily completely clear forward, I hope we will really use this knowledge and information to continue to hone what I, you know, frankly believe, not just self-servingly, this is the cutting edge of this field in this country. What's happening here in this region is really leading the way. So I want to make sure we're able to take that expertise and apply it and learn, and also to keep the network alive. Sometimes these events bring in folks from places like Wisconsin or Oregon, and those people go back and say, that was really cool, and I got to meet some neat people. But I hope in the context of communication, we will really keep those connections and continue to have your expert advice really play out in terms of how we implement programs going forward. So, thank you very much for being here. What I'd like you to do is all stand up.
And going off the talking point.
So take a look around at a couple of folks near you, and I want you to look at their eyes. Eyeballs to eyeballs. Good, good. And now I want you to give yourself a big round of applause. This is your own standing ovation.
Jamie, again for him.
Yes. Thank you, Paige. All right, so I think without further ado, I will reintroduce Dr. Bill McBeth to share his insights on the NELA study.
Before we get started, could we close the curtains behind you, because that backlighting is, I don't know if it's bothering anybody else. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I think
yes, it's on the podium.
Physically close them, we have to press a button. Okay. It's on the podium. Blinds closed. How big are you? Oh.
I will. Yeah, the cone of silence comes down next. Dr. Trudy Volk's is a member of the team, and she's here to help with the presentation too. She knows as much or more than I do about this.
I'm his wingman.
There should be a clicker right on the. Oh, there it is.
You got to be wingman yesterday.
I did.
Yeah.
So I was here less than a year ago and did the same presentation. I know some of you were in the room. So this is a cut down version, but I did tell you a little bit about myself, and I think I probably told you that I grew up on a farm, and I probably told you that I'm one of the owners of a locally sourced kind of a co-op kind of store. So we try to live those principles, environmental principles, in a different way. And I probably told you the best joke that I have, and that is that I grew up in small town Nebraska, and it's so flat you can watch a dog run away for 3 days. I probably told you that joke. But I don't think I told you another factoid about Nebraska, and that is that they have the highest percentage of Rhodes Scholars in their athletics departments of any university, public, private, in the country. That's why the letter N on their football helmet stands for knowledge. I am a huge Nebraska football fan, and now that we're in the Big Ten, and you know, all know that's the conference that can't count. All right, so on with the presentation. This is, we're going to talk to you about, we're going to thank people first. We're going to thank NOAA for the help that they have given us, the support they've given us. The U.S. EPA, NAAAE was very supportive in our efforts. Members and other environmental educators associated with NAAAE and NOT were data collectors for us as we went around the country trying to gather our data. And lastly, but not least, they participated in schools, administrators, teachers, and students. Very, very, very valuable in the work that we did here. Going to briefly summarize phase one and phase two data. Phase one data was the baseline study. It was a random national sample. Phase two was a purposeful study. One of the differences was that phase one we had sixth and eighth graders. Phase two we had seventh and eighth graders. And so this is kind of the NELA Cliff Notes version. It was really, really short. I'll give you the URL at the very end if you really want to go into those two documents to take a closer look. They're pretty extensive. They cover very, very well what we did, the methodology, so it could be replicated if at any time somebody really, really wanted to do that. And phase three, which is what we're entering right now, we just received funding from NOAA to complete this, and we're taking, this is really kind of where they wanted me to spend some time, and I'll show you what we're doing, but I really can't do much with it because we haven't gotten very far on it, other than to organize the data, which is huge. The data set is absolutely huge, and to do these statistical runs, we have to organize the set so that you know, basically you tell the computer what you want it to do and it can do it. I've got a sampling of that. I'll show you some of the types of data that we collected, and hopefully at NAAAE we'll be able to give you a little bit more information about predictability of some of these variables on environmental literacy, we hope. So in terms of literacy, what we measured, we've got validity and reliability associated with this. Is this all there is to environmental literacy? Absolutely not. But this is what we thought were the most important things that we could do within a reasonable test period with middle school students. So that's why we have selected these, and they're all research-based. Ecological knowledge, these are the four composite areas, or component areas: ecological knowledge, affect, cognitive skills, and actual commitment, which is the behavior. And all of these are the ecological knowledge, verbal commitment, sensitivity, environmental feelings, the cognitive skills, and behavior are scales that we actually measured and we collected data on. But we did collapse it into these two categories, and that's what I'll present to you is those collapsed data. Component scores. We won't spend any time on the scale scores. As I said before, sample one was a random sample. We worked with GFK Roper to pull our sample. We stayed as far away from that as we possibly could because we know that that's where you can introduce bias, and so we paid somebody to do that. Used their sampling technology. Very happy with the sample. It's completely described in the report. If you want to go in and see how representative it is of the population, that's fine. All those things worked out. Phase two was a purposeful sample. So now that we had this baseline sample, it doesn't mean anything unless you have something to compare it to. You know, just this is the state of where we are. But what does that mean? We really don't know. So to try to make some sense of where the field is, we did a purposeful sample where we had a nomination process. We started this in Biloxi, Mississippi, right? Mm-hmm. Wasn't it in 2006, we had a meeting with Project Wild and, you know, some other folks. We had a flyer in the NAAAE packet and announced that we were doing this, and we were going to be recruiting schools that people thought were doing a really good job with environmental education. And so that's how we pulled our sample, partly that way. Partly we got online, we looked at Green School Award winners, things like that. And then we had a screening process. Part of our criteria were that you had to have an environmental program in place for 2 years because we wanted to see, you know, some sustained impacts of environmental education, not something that was just up and running. I might mention, too, that we collected all our data in the spring as late as we possibly could without impacting our results. So we wanted total effects of student maturation to take place and total effects of environmental programming to take place as much as possible. That's what we collected our data in the spring or late spring. We have had states that have requested using this in their environmental literacy plans for their assessments. And we always, you know, if you want a true comparison, we tell them you have to collect the data in the spring. Because, you know, for those two very, very important reasons, you know, students change over the course of an academic year. Ask any middle school teacher. They'll tell you there's a huge difference between a sixth grader coming in and a sixth grader going out, and an eighth grader coming in and an eighth grader going out. So you want to get these kids at a true look at them and at that developmental level, and also a true look at the impact schools and other things have had on them in terms of environmental programming. 30 states in phase one, 27 in phase two. You see that we have a lot more, and we included the seventh graders in phase two, not in phase one. Financial reasons kind of precluded us from keep doing seventh graders, and so we picked what we thought were the two most important students coming in and students leaving. We had a little bit more funding in phase two, so we included all grades. You know, we really wanted schools, if as much as possible, to have three grades represented because it's expensive to do this kind of work, and you want to get the maximum amount of return for the dollars that you spent. So we did have schools in there that had 6th, 7th, 8th grades. We also had schools that had 6th and 7th or 7th and 8th grade that participated in the study. So this tells you the numbers of students that we had. So our phase two is a sample of students who were in schools nominated for supposedly doing high-quality environmental education. Okay. And here are the component scores. Ecological knowledge, which is the, there it is. Ecological knowledge is the first component. Affect was composed of three scales, right? The skills was composed of three scales, and the behavior was a standalone scale on its own. Interesting to notice that in the phase one, so the blues are the phase one, 6 and 8, and the lighter blue and the green are the phase two, 6 and 8. It's interesting to note that in the self-reported components, affect and behavior, that the sixth graders outscored the eighth graders in both phase one and phase two of the study. So sixth graders outscored the eighth graders, sixth graders outscored the eighth graders. We might infer, we don't know for sure why that occurred, but it was consistent. And actually, it was pretty consistent where in phase two, the seventh graders, for the most part, fell in between the sixth and the eighth graders. So, you know, pretty happy with the data that we had. I think it adds a layer of validity to it. We might, though, infer that maybe as kids get older and more advanced in their environmental education or their education, they know a little bit more about what they're doing. That could be something developmental where sixth graders have more confidence than eighth graders, you know, about certain things. We don't really know, but it's something that's of interest.
Bill, that's also in that review of studies that I did with the evaluation studies on the behavior front, that was a clear evidence.
Yeah, did they have an inference for it? Okay.
Just to show that, so there are other studies that show the same kind of thing.
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating. You know, it'd be kind of fun to figure out why something like that happens. The knowledge, you see steady differences. There's which we would expect to have an impact on, you know, something you can, that's not self-reported, like I feel this way, I believe this way, I believe I act this way, but, you know, what is questions? What is the difference between an ecosystem and something else? Or, you know, what is a predator-prey relationship? Things like that. More typical types of questions, we get good responses, you know, and you can see pretty high gains by the phase two eighth graders. Here, there was in the affect, there was a significant difference between the phase one and the phase two sixth and eighth grades.
What is the y-axis?
This is the mean. I'm sorry. Those are the means.
Is
50
the top?
60 is the top. I've got another slide. This next slide explains that a little bit better. These were not exactly equal scales. The students could score varying amounts on the different scales. So these component scores don't add up equally if you were just to do a raw tally of the scores. So to make sense and be able to compare across the different scales and across the different component scores, we equated everything to the highest, which was 60. So all these are equal to 60 points. So we used multipliers on all these others so that we could compare across scales. That way, you know, otherwise you wouldn't see that the skills was the lowest. You wouldn't be able to see that relationship between skills and the rest of the scales. Okay, so it's a good question. Thank you for asking that. Yeah, that axis is the mean scores, scaled mean scores. And you see significant differences in the behavior between the phase one and phase two as well. This skills is, I believe, really, really important. The cognitive skills part, that's the issue investigation, issue identification, action planning part, which is critical thinking, some real heavy critical thinking there. In my opinion, and I'm sure you would probably agree, I think that this is probably one area where we could invest a little and gain a lot. You know, kids, this is probably, if we really wanted to move literacy in terms of how we've measured it and what we've done in the study, I would sink some time here because it's got the most room to move, right? It's the lowest consistently.
And this is what we're talking about, thinking citizens. You know, we want environmental literacy. We want decision makers. It's just not enough for them to have the knowledge. They did pretty well with that, but they have to be able to do something with it. That's what Noah wants. You know, Noah wants people who can hear things and think about things and look at it in the community and make sense and then make some decisions.
So So skills are to analyze, not to plant a tree, right? Like, what's a skill?
Right.
Okay.
It is a cognitive skill.
Cognitive. Right. Issue identification, issue analysis.
Skills related to behavior, because I was wondering the same thing. Because the behavior they dwell on, so are the skills necessary to the behavior, or is there a complete disconnect between the behavior and the skills?
There should be, I don't quite know, they're going to have behavior, I don't know if it's thinking behavior or not. Behavior is self-reported. You know, there's no way in something like, in an assessment like this to observe their behaviors. So they have to report on what they're doing.
I've done some regression, it's nothing that will be printed, and if you write it down, I'm going to have to take your notes and burn them. It was a real quick look for this group at those scale scores and what they mean in terms of verbal commitment, which is the behavior component. So I've got that regression. I can show you that regression, but it's just nothing more than this is kind of interesting. It's not something you can take home and say, this is it. So, you know, I kind of hesitate to do it, but I've got those in here and we'll probably look at them because, you know, that's, to me, and what we're talking about here is the behavior. You know, we measured environmental literacy, which is a different concept than environmental behavior. Behavior, as we look at it, is a part of literacy, but the ultimate test of a literate person is how they behave. You know, you can be really smart at math, but if you don't apply it, who cares? I don't care. You know, if you can be really knowledgeable about environmental science and be able to be a critical thinker and have these skills, but if you don't act in positive environmental ways, I really don't much care. I'm really after this. It's the behavior, as far as I'm concerned, that I'm after, and that's a lot of, you know, with the stewardship, that's what you're talking about here, too.
But it makes sense that the affect and the behavior are a lot alike, because and yes. self-reported, so they're probably measuring very similar.
Yes.
And is it change in behavior you're measuring, or
no?
No, this it's just
yeah. so change. Don't change would, change knowledge. In behavior would be over time.
Right.
This is a point in time.
Okay.
This is like this. These are things that I say I do now. Now, if we were to do this again, say compared to when you did this the first time, how would you rate your change? Behavior, mm-hmm. or something like that? Then we could say it's a change in behavior.
Right.
This is that other table that I was talking about. This and we debated on whether to put any labels on levels of environmental literacy because we didn't want it to be misunderstood, because we really, you know, we can't say that, well, there are, that, you know, in terms of grading environmental literacy, this person's a 90 because they got that many points out of 150 total score points, right? We can't say that because we don't know that much about it. So We divided the ranges into three equal categories, and that's how we did it. So understand it's a hypothesized, nothing more than a hypothesized level of environmental literacy, just for discussion purposes. Mm-hmm. Okay, but these are in the report. I mean, we did identify low, moderate to high levels in the report. But it's kind of interesting to know that in terms of high ecological knowledge, hey, guess what? We must be doing okay. I mean, we're doing okay. That makes sense. That's where we focus. That's for the most part where our education system focuses, is on the ecological knowledge part. Affect, we're in the moderate ranges. We're you could say we're doing okay. Shows our significant differences between sixth graders in phase one and two and eighth graders in phase one and two. You see that this is consistent too, where the eighth graders scored the lowest, followed by the seventh graders who scored a little higher, followed by the sixth graders who scored the highest on that affective component. And you'll see that here too, within the phases. So we thought it was kind of interesting, really interesting, the seventh graders filled in that gap and followed those patterns of high and low.
What's statistically significant? Is two? Is one? Like what?
This is statistically significantly larger than this.
Okay.
And this is.
Oh, gotcha. And okay. One with the stars. All
right. Yeah. So it's comparing across the phases.
Bill, the differences are small.
Yeah.
Very small. I mean, very
yep.
small. So,
very small.
Those green schools again, you know, are they really any?
Yeah.
We don't know, but that's something we're going to find out. That's something we'll find out how much difference that makes, but that's the phase three part of it.
We used statistical machinations. We took the most conservative view of this.
Mm-hmm.
Because there were so many comparisons made, we divided the Bonferroni, so that makes it even harder to
right.
meet the test of significance. And you know, we really had mixed feelings about this.
Mm-hmm.
It looks as if the green school, the schools with environmental programming are doing better, but they're doing a little better.
Yeah,
you know what? You know what we really wanted to see. We really wanted to see what you want to see. So,
but within your phase one schools, you may well have some schools that are
that's true.
Doing.
That's
we
true.
Do.
Did you look at we had 18.
Yeah.
18 of them
right.
were
oh,
that's
so you have
environmental
to be able to parse them out to
yeah,
really
right,
do
right.
that.
Yeah,
yeah.
And we did. We took
yeah.
the phase one report has an analysis
right.
of the difference between those schools. And just the schools that didn't.
Right.
Okay.
Well, and the other thing I was thinking is that, I mean, a lot of what we've been working on for the last 10, 20 years is trying to get whole states to embrace this. So part of the lack of a contrast is the fact that we've been trying to push it as a systemic thing, right? Is there some truth to that?
I mean, so in some ways, phase one is
I mean, that's just what your read of the country.
Yes.
Based on your random.
That's, you know, that you could look at that as the norm sample, mm-hmm. in a sense.
Which includes schools doing environmental work.
Right. Right.
Which is not.
You're doing really well.
Which includes, like, the end result of us trying to make this a mainstream thing.
I get it. I understand your question.
You know what but I mean? Like, so.
Yes, but here's the thing, too, that in phase one, we had 49 schools, almost 50 schools. 18 of them reported environmental programming. Right. Roughly 36% of the schools.
But that's what you're saying.
Nationwide.
That, you know, we can take a look at that as a reflection of the efforts to make environmental education mainstream across the country, is that we had 37% of the schools in the random sample had identifiable environmental education programs.
Yeah. Yes. So it's a success in the way that there's not a contrast.
We didn't look at it. That's interesting.
Okay. I'm just a glasses half full person. That's all.
That's good though, because we had never thought of that in all the discussions, and it's an interesting take.
Did you back it out at all? Have you done any analysis backing those 18 out?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I can't. Yeah, we did. That's in the phase one report, and I can't tell you right off the top of my head.
There weren't significant differences between those 18 and the rest of the samples in anything. But it seems to me, in a way similar to this, there were some small differences.
Mm-hmm. We did some t-tests, and I just can't remember.
Yeah, I know we didn't get any significant differences.
Okay. Yeah.
Did you take into account the coursework at the specific grade levels when you were looking at these different categories? For example, in Virginia in seventh grade, environmental literacy pretty much lives with the life science curriculum, whereas in eighth grade, they tend to go through the physical science curriculum, which doesn't lend itself as much to the environmental literacy. So
we've got that information.
At the differences.
We will be looking at that. We have, that's phase three. You know, that's where we start breaking this down. And we take a look at the characteristics of the variables that interact to develop literacy, not just the measurements of literacy, but how the school's made up, that at least as it's been reported, how teachers run their classes, class sizes, socioeconomics, you know, all those kinds of things, how they, and where their environmental programming is, the length of it, all those, you know, we've got, oh, I want to say 70 some odd variables to take a look at. Because, again, we have the money. We wanted to do, we knew we had one shot at it, and so we created these forums to ask about the program, about the teachers, and about the school in general, so that we had these variables that when we got ready to get back to it, and to take a look at and see what kind of impact those variables have on the development of environmental literacy. So, short, yeah, we got them.
My first question was the same, looking at, especially thinking about the talks we had yesterday, but the implementation of these environmental literacy efforts will vary dramatically, the duration of them, so you have that data already.
Yep, and you'll see, I've got some samples of some later on some slides of the types of data that we have.
And then the other side was, is it possible, in terms of response variable, to look... I think we all probably have a sense that there could be impacts beyond these four things. It could affect the community, it could affect the teacher's attitude, it could affect the families. Do you have any of that data beyond these four?
No, we just looked at the school environment. Mm-hmm. Our plans our plans are for a fourth phase of this. And the fourth phase is to go in and do qualitative analysis of school. We have to find out, we have to make sure we still know what we think we know. So we're going to have to assess the schools again. But once we find that they're high performing, we want to have and to have groups of researchers looking for the same things in the same ways, go into these schools and take a look at those cultural interactions that we can't measure this way. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can only learn so much doing the things that we did. And then you have to go in and live the life, so to speak. You have to do qualitative analysis. Mm-hmm. But the quantitative leads us down the road to see where we want to go. And then we go in there using qualitative analysis to flush out the real story, so to speak. And then, you know, hopefully produce some case studies of schools with best practices, at least as we know it now. So that's the road we're going down. We're not there yet. And that's a scary road to me. It's an exciting road, but it's scary. There's a lot of unknowns in something. There are a lot of unknowns in this stuff, but there's even more in that one for me anyway. Yeah.
My question would be, of those schools that are doing environmental education, why are they doing environmental education? In other words, is in their standardized testing, how much environmental education and science is in that content that's driving that?
That's a good question. What's their motive for doing it? That's asked a similar question kind of yesterday in terms of what we're doing here. What's somebody's incentive to participate? You know, and now that they know how they're doing and whatever assessment comes out of here, what's their incentive to change? I don't know. I can't answer that question here. Their incentive, they got a report. They got a report from us.
$500.
It wasn't much, but it was a little bit of incentive. I think probably more the report was probably what drove more of them being selected into this, and then getting a customized report showing how they did, and then comparing how they did to the random sample to give them some kind of an idea on where they lie. We as the nominator nominated more than two schools, they got one too. But we promised schools anonymity, and we still promise schools anonymity. So we couldn't give a nominator, if they only nominated one school, a report because they'd know the school. And we figured they could probably figure it out with two schools, and so we did it with three or more. So, but that's all they got in terms of what we did. It's not much incentive, but you know, there is an amount of altruism out there. There's an amount of pride in what people are trying to do to see if what they're doing makes a difference. Because I think everybody who's serious about what they do wants to believe they're making a difference. Mm-hmm. How do they know that they are? Well, this is one way to begin to get that picture.
This is kind of for all the researchers here, but you actually had another piece that I'll ask you directly. That I'm wondering what the research field says in large data sets on scale analysis. Does it trend toward the middle?
Mm-hmm.
Like the bigger the data set, does it kind of end up in the middle? And if that was true, then a small variation in what you're seeing in your score would be really powerful. Like if the trend is, you know, because what I wonder if what you're picking up on is there's this huge range of implementation in school, and there's all these other factors going on in the schools that aren't even operating schools. How well it's run, is there transitions, is there teacher turnover, mm-hmm. is there budget cuts? And like, I wonder if you're picking up on all that in this large data set. And then what you said is like, if you were to look at individual schools, do you see more variation? Does it jump around more when you're looking at the individual schools?
Well, I'm sure this reflects some of that. I mean, it has to. It has to reflect some of what's going on in the school. You know, if teachers, maybe there's a really good program going on in the school and teachers got dumped on for some reason. In middle school, somebody changed their teams. You know, that has a huge impact on teachers and how they behave for a while anyway. If things like that went on in these schools, yeah, absolutely, it's going to impact the quality of instruction intentionally or unintentionally and how students perform.
Can you repeat the question for the people on the phone? They just asked to repeat it.
The question had to do with N sizes and how things regress to the mean, right, with large sample sizes. Yeah.
And did you see big variations on a school-to-school basis?
And did we see big variations on school-to-school basis with
regard to your score? So, like, if you looked at your entire set, were the lines kind of even, or did they kind of jump around, and then your data just reflects kind of a...
I've got that with me. I can always sit down with you and show you that too. This shows the composite scores. So these are the complete scores. You see this is phase one, and this is phase two. So the effect size, I think Michela mentioned effect size yesterday. Effect size, as we look at it, is the amount of educational gain between the population and the sample. This would be the population. This would be the sample. Phase one would be the population. Phase two would be the sample. And you get that statistically. You get that by subtracting the difference in the means and the dividing by the standard deviation of the population. So, you know, we take a look at normal curves in education sometimes and see how we're doing. This represents the mean standard deviations. And if we can move education to the, you know, hopefully to the right, we're making positive gains. Okay? And so I look at this as it's a positive gain. It's a small gain. Effect size of 0.38 plus 0.38% or 38%. So that's good, though. I mean, that still means things are working. But we contrast that with the eighth grade. Same mathematical formula, and we get an effect size of 72% of a standard deviation. That's pretty good. That's a pretty large gain. So that tells me, in terms of overall environmental literacy scores, things are working. Mm-hmm. And probably what's having a greater impact is the continuous investment in education, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, or at least across 2 grade levels. Okay, so we think that's really, really important. Can't be episodic. It's got to be continually addressed in education. Okay. Questions on this one?
You had that loss in 2 categories from 6th to 8th grade.
Mm-hmm.
So.
But that was. phase two still outscored phase one.
Uh-huh.
It was just within the studies, the 6th graders outscored the 8th graders.
I'm wondering about 6 compared to 8. Did you mean
a similar comparison like this?
Yeah.
No.
Mm-hmm. No. We were just looking at the 2 different phases.
Right.
2 different kinds of schools.
Some quick findings: more classrooms and schools than phase two scored above the phase one mean, which, you know, adds a little bit of insight that overall all the schools were doing better in terms of environmental literacy as we measured it. As a group, 6th, 8th grade students in the U.S. are moderate to high in their ecological understandings. Results from different grade levels within a school were not always consistent, so sometimes 7th graders within a school outscored 8th graders in the composite scores. Sometimes 6th graders outscored 8th graders. It just depended, you know, and that makes sense. Depends on who's teaching, doesn't it? You know, we've talked about passion and environmental sensitivity probably making a difference in what people are doing. And I think maybe that has some explanation here, that if you've got a 6th grader who's getting their kids out there and they love it and they spend more time on it and they're excited about teaching it, and then you get a 7th grader or 8th grade teacher that has to teach it, yeah, it's going to have an impact, probably. As a group, 2 8th grade composite scores are significantly higher than those of phase one. Socioeconomic status, and we did this with some of the school information form. We did some quartiling work that I don't have reported here, but it wasn't a finding that socioeconomic status and ethnicity appeared to differentiate between schools in the top and the bottom quartiles. You can get into the phase two report and see that work. Cognitive skills, why hypothesize at moderate levels are at low end of this range and can be an area where significant gains are made. Talked about that already. Schools with ongoing school-based environmental education programs can do make a difference across major components of environmental literacy. And we talked about that a little bit too. So into the surveys really quick. We had these 4 surveys. The student survey was the MISCL environmental literacy instrument, and that's pretty much what we've been reporting on right now. School form, program form, and teacher form. We did have these demographics, age, grade, gender, ethnicity on the school form. Then we get to the school sample surveys. There were 10 variables on that, and some examples are grade level configuration. Now, what type of school, what's your school look like? Enrollment, how large or small, type of school, charter school, magnet school, public school, parochial school, Yep. Maybe make a difference. We don't know. Location of the school, student-teacher ratio, number reduced free lunch, school-wide theme. Is this like the Lieberman School, for example? Is it a green school kind of thing? Okay. Do those, and we, so we collected that information on the school form. The EE program forms had 17 variables associated with it. Grade level involvement in EE, so which grades were there. Nature of the EE program, was it episodic, you know, was it Project Wild, was it something identifiable, was it something that they created, was it part of the Earth Science program, what was it? Years the program existed by grade level, program affiliation with an EE network, program use of EE curricula, classroom teaching methods, classroom assessment techniques, things like that. So, and this is just a few of the 17. Okay. Teacher information survey. We had 23 variables. Years of teaching, certification type, college courses, gender, ethnicity, teacher preparation. These are interesting. I've got a number problem with this one, so I left it off, just so you know, but I've got some data on these. The teacher preparation of importance of EE to students, teacher preparation of importance to EE to self, teacher sensitivity toward the environment, teacher concern on environmental problems and issues, and then level of environmental action for teachers. If we take a look at those questions, this is the phase one teachers, phase two teachers. So we've clumped these into not all slightly. So importance of EE to students, no teachers in phase one said it wasn't, or it was only kind of important. And in phase two, none said that. 50% of the respondents in phase one said it was moderately, 6%. Phase two, 80% said it was extremely or considerably, and 92%. So you do see in phase two, you see consistently higher responses by teachers in phase two than phase one.
Did you pull out those teachers and their student data specific to the teachers to see if there was a correlation?
Not yet.
That's what we're going to try to do.
Yeah, not yet. Yes, ma'am.
Did you consider measuring environmental literacy of the teachers? Can you repeat the question?
I'm sorry. The first question was, did we pull the?
No.
Well, did we take a look at the students who were taught by teachers who, and in the response to these questions, these four or five questions that we're talking about right now, and the answer was not yet. And then the next question was?
If you consider looking at environmental literacy of the teachers.
Oh, did we consider looking at the environmental literacy of teachers? No.
Wouldn't that be a great study? But I think it's a separate one.
We actually, this orange number was designed for middle school students. Can we use it as adults? You know, we don't have an adult research base. Is there an adult instrument out there? Yeah, probably, but we didn't do it. Yeah.
It would be interesting to look at the same.
Yeah, it would be interesting. You it would be.
Did it on the other slide, didn't it say that you had you know how many environmental education courses?
Yes.
Teachers have, which I would say, what do you mean by that? Because I would fit all the biologies into that and other stuff.
So. We asked the type and quality too.
You did, okay.
Courses, yeah.
Because that would sort of get at that.
Yeah, a little bit. It would help. Just because you've taken a course doesn't make you
necessarily. I agree.
But it might give us some insights.
And I'm not sure if this question was answered earlier. Did you consider, as we're talking about sixth grade students compared to the sixth grade students compared to the sixth grade students, you know, in the years past, the students have changed. So is there a baseline data of the students on each student? In other words, this student entered my classroom with this particular skill set and knowledge, and what I want to know is the longitudinal data of that student's growth.
Mm-hmm.
Was that measured?
No.
Are there plans to measure that?
No, this is not a longitudinal study.
This is a snapshot.
This is a point in time study. If you want, and I would really reluctantly do this, you could kind of look at it as a compressed longitudinal study
where, you know, the comparison, you'd have to really dig in and take a look at the sixth grade, those that have sixth, seventh, and eighth grade, and take a look at the relationship between environmental literacy between the sixth, the seventh, and the eighth grade, assuming some of the other variables didn't change in there, and you kind of get a picture of a longitudinal study. The longitudinal studies are extremely expensive, very expensive, and we just didn't do it.
You can.
Well, I'm thinking even just the child entering that school year and the child exiting that school year.
You mean like a pre-post test?
Yeah, okay, pre-post test and then do it a year to year. One of the conversations last night and the idea of teacher evaluation and the effectiveness of the teacher and effectiveness of programs is I'm not afraid of that kind of evaluation as long as I have the pre and post of that student. Mm-hmm. So I know what was the effect of the program, what was the effect of the teacher on that student that year.
Right.
There's one thing that I really want to impress on you. This is the very first instrument of its kind. Mm-hmm. The field had been, there were writings in the field for this for 20 years prior saying, you know, one of the problems with the research is in this study it's measured this way, in this study it's measured that way, in this study it's measured this way, and oops, there isn't even validity and reliability in that instrument. So we don't know what's going on. So now we think we have a picture of what is was going on at that point in time for the sixth and eighth grade only.
Yeah.
But at least we have an instrument that's valid and reliable and can be used for the other things that you're now thinking of doing with them, which are wonderful things.
You know, for the most part, we've had programmatic assessments. And that's wonderful. I think that's really good. And Michelle, and I think a couple other people said yesterday, one of the first things you start out with, what are your objectives? You know, what is it that you're trying to accomplish with your program? So that makes assessments program specific. And you can't really compare. You can kind of get a picture, but it's not a fair comparison across those program assessments because their objectives are different. Here, our objectives was to measure environmental literacy across a broad spectrum of middle school students.
So we're low on time. Do you have more slides?
One more question.
Okay. I'm really interested in hearing either Trudy or Bill say a little bit more about what went into the development of the instrument, how choices were made, with what items to include, what you just chose, you know,
it was my dissertation.
Ecological knowledge.
It was my dissertation.
Part of it,
yes. It was validity and reliability.
You need to get the URL for the phase one report because there's quite a bit in there about the development of it, the instrument and the testing of it, et cetera.
Yeah.
So I really don't think we have time.
I think it's a great lunch conversation.
But the questions did focus on the variables of environmentally responsive behavior.
Right.
Presented yesterday.
Yes, the variables of responsible behavior came out of the literacy frameworks that have been evolving over time that Bora did a great deal of work with, trying to pull all of them together and make sense of them. And so we kind of stood on her shoulders at that point and pulled the variables out and said, okay, now how do we, are there existing measures that we can incorporate? Do we have to, you know, come up with some new ones? And we tried them out and field tested them and did all that. That's the short story.
Yeah, I'm really not being flip. The instrument was in development for years, literally years, going through various permutations and research, and it's not an easy process to put an instrument together that does something like this. Okay, very quickly, I was given half an hour, 45 minutes. All right, this is the regression analysis. So phase 1-6, phase 1-8, phase 2-6, phase 2-8, left seventh graders out there because they weren't important in this particular discussion right now. But in terms of the dependent variable was commitment or self-reported behavior, okay, which is what we wanted to look at in this thing. And this tells you the relative importance of these variables in the relationship to behavior. So verbal commitment was the strongest predictor all the way across. Hello, research says it. This confirmed it. We better believe it. Okay. We need to pay attention to that now in modeling as we go through phase three in modeling. What is it that develops verbal commitment? Will definitely be something we're going to be paying attention to try to figure out. What are the variables that go into the development of this thing? Because it's strong. Verbal commitment is strong, and it's shown up throughout the years, study after study, as being a strong
predictor of environmental responsible behavior. Okay, ecological knowledge and sensitivity. And it's kind of interesting that as we got into phase two, we picked up more of the variability, and it changed down into, we started getting into some of the cognitive skills as being important in terms of the development of environmental literacy. Okay. So this is where we're going with phase three. This is just a sneak peek, and you can't take this with you. Okay? I'm serious. This won't be published. This is the only place this will be seen, and it's just for your benefit. And without taking a better look, I can't speak to the veracity of this right now. Okay, I did it on the quick because I thought it would be good for you to see where we're going and what the potential of something like this in phase three is. Okay.
How much you paying us?
$500. $500. I figured you would want to eat stats for breakfast.
So one last question. Is there anything that you've seen from this work to date? I know phase three is probably going to surface more of this, but that would, in a way, contradict a lot of what we all have been trying to do in terms of following the various practices that we've been following.
You know, for what you're trying to do, I was fairly skeptical, to be honest, when we started talking about this. You're going to give a survey to our school representative, and you're going to figure out how things are going, right? And that's kind of the gist. Is that right?
Yeah.
Something like that. Kind of the gist. That was what I was taking away from it. And as we begin to talk more about teachers, I begin to become more of a believer that maybe we can figure out a set of predictors on teachers. And if teachers are behaving in a certain way and carry certain attitudes and beliefs with them, maybe, just maybe, that's going to translate into practice in the classroom. Don't know for sure, but maybe. And so in my mind, I'm thinking that may be the best bet, is to go after the teachers in a sense. Because you don't want to go after the students, so who are you going to go after? I wouldn't go after the administrators, right? Because they're invested in something else, in the running of the school, not necessarily in the teaching of the school. So.
And the teachers probably have the strongest impact on the students. And that is probably regardless of the program. I'm going to say that. What the teachers know and can do and want to do, etc.
There might be, I'm with you guys, I thought on the practice front, the teacher, asking the teachers, I remember talking about this earlier, teacher practice, what are they actually doing, maybe what are some of their characteristics along the ideas of what Mark was talking about. Mm-hmm. But I think there might be something on the administrator side, just in terms of what's their support of PE, because we know that's going to influence the teacher. So I think there might be a chain of things.
You know, just on a real quick note, Kevin and you were all talking about your clothing, right? This morning, how you were dressed in our uniform. Your uniform. And I'm a firm believer in gray animals for male adults. You know what gray animals are? You mask the lion with the lion, you go to the store and they all fit. Because whenever I come down in the morning, my wife always goes, oh, another monochromatic day. You know, it's like I buy two pairs of jeans, they're all the same, and two shirts, and they're all the same. It makes it easy for me. Thank you. All right, go here.
All right, we are going to quickly switch gears, and I think is an appropriate time.
Tell people on the line to mute themselves.
Okay, could people that are on the conference call mute themselves?
We're just getting some feedback a little bit. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right, so quickly switching gears, I think after, it's somewhat, I think, fitting after this, which is a look at what's actually happening in schools across the country, to now hear more about other things that are happening in schools across the country, other than environmental education and their relevance, in a sense, their opportunities that they provide for environmental education. So we have three folks that are going to share this information briefly. There's a whole lot more than they can fit into the 10 minutes or so that we have for each one Lori Jenkins, the supervisor in Montgomery County Public Schools for their environmental and outdoor education program. Andrea Falcon, who I believe we have on the phone.
Not sure. You there?
Andrea, are you on the phone?
She sent an email that she was having trouble.
Okay, so we'll come
back. She has the line.
More time for Lori and Jennifer.
Yes, we'll come back to Andrea if she's on the phone. And then lastly, Jennifer Tabola. Andrea is with the U.S. Department of Education and runs the Green Ribbon Schools program. Jennifer Tabola, who's Senior Director of Education for National Environmental Education Foundation, is going to share her thoughts on STEM. And so I will first turn it over to Lori, who is going to talk a little bit about the next generation science standards and maybe disciplinary literacy. If you want to
I can throw that in. I'll try that. Okay. Gary, at some point, would you get the levels for me?
One to everybody.
Yeah, you can just put them on to that.
Sure.
Thank you.
This is Jennifer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Both blonde.
A trade-off. It's all those blondes. We all have the same. All right. Good morning. This is going to be a little bit different. We're only doing four slides today, and I am supervisor of Outdoor and Environmental Education Program. So that's a program, a sort of a outdoor school that our county. For those of you that are out of our area, it's a very large. We have 202 schools and 149,000 students in our system. So we also then have this wonderful feature of having an outdoor education school. And so I can tell you more about that at lunchtime or whatever, but that's where I'm coming from. But I'm also in charge of PK through grade 12 environmental literacy, and so that's the other part that I'm doing. This is actually the title slide, not from what I'm doing today. You would think that, right? But I just presented at the Environmental Literacy Summit that Allegheny County, Montgomery County, and MSDE sort of put together with help from many other people. And they had asked me to do a talk on this, environmental literacy, and how it melds with the next generation science standards. And you can see, look at my title. A perfect match. Okay, so that's telling you where I come from, totally. And the reason that I say that, and is this going to be a problem? What do I need to do? There's a pointer right up there for you.
All right, yep. And I hit
the arrow.
I'm not ready to move yet. Okay, I'll move there.
Okay.
A couple of things that make me consider it a perfect match right off the bat. And one of them is a personal story, and a couple of people have heard this, but the rest of you have not. My youngest son was really struggling in high school to figure out what he wanted to do when he got to college. And people would ask him all the time, and he's a very sensitive kid, and he'd be like, I don't really know, you know. And then he decided when he was in college, got to Maryland, University of Maryland, and he decided he was going into environmental science. Mom and Dad were like, oh, cool, okay. But he went through all of that, got through, and loved it, absolutely loved everything that he was doing with environmental science. And I never really said to him until I was interviewed by the Post on something, the Washington Post. And after that, they were asking me about, you know, sort of why people choose this. And so I asked my own son. he's like 22 now. I said, Brian, why did you decide to go into this environmental science area? And for him, it was his advanced placement environmental science course that he took when he was a high school senior. And I said, why though? Why did that course have that effect? And he said, you know what, Mom, it was the first time I had a course that connected all the dots. Mm-hmm. So that's why that's there. Because to me, what he was saying to me is now all those science classes I have make sense. It's all these, now I can apply them to something that's real, the environmental part of it. And so, and they all gave him a lot of background in order to go into that environmental science course that he was taking. And also, he was very, he's become, and during those years, also very involved with issues. Now, did they do issues investigation when he was in his APES class? No, he did not. But that's where his interest started, right there, with the kind of content that they were doing and making those connections for him and making him see everything much larger than he had been seeing. Okay, so that's where I come out this, right? So as a science person myself and listening to my son, but today's focus is this. Okay, this is what we've been asked to talk about. How can environmental education advance the goals of the new generation science standards? And so when I had to go to goals, I was really going away from the standards themselves and had to go back really to the framework. Many of you have seen all this, okay? This is sort of the abridged version. This is the cheap version, okay? But this one is the actual book, Framework. And I have them here. If you don't have it, you certainly could take a look at it. You can purchase it. But there's, of course, the information is very rich. But to do this, to answer this question, advance the goals of the new generation science standards, I needed to go back to the vision. And the vision is, guess where? In the framework, okay? So in the framework, we have, this is goal one from the vision statements in the framework. And it says, educating all students in science and engineering. So, Gary, this is student handout. This will be a good time. Okay, thank you. This is where, are we good? I keep moving because I'm
you're
a teacher.
You're fine. Don't worry about it. You're fine.
Teachers move around the room and do all that business, okay? Even though I haven't taught in a number of years, those tricks always stay with you. Okay, so what we're going to do is take a look now. When we look at educating all students in science and engineering, and we look at, does environmental education do that? Do our best practices do that? So what you're going to be seeing right now, if you have not had a chance to really take a look at the dimensions, the three dimensions that have become the framework for the new generation science standards, this will give you the opportunity. Okay? So when I was working with teachers, we really drilled down into this at a different level that we're going to do right now. But if you look at our best practices environmental education and you look at the three dimensions, the practices, these are what we used to be called the process skills sort of in science, but now they're the practices because it's much broader than that. There's a lot of knowledge that goes behind those skills. So in environmental education, some of our best practices, as we talked about yesterday, are about asking questions, investigating questions, getting the knowledge to ask even better questions, design experiments, design models of things. So we have all these science and engineering practices. If you look at every one of them, I don't think there's one you could say that environmental education we're not involved in. So right away, there's a walk-in with the practices. I mean, with teachers, I say the same thing. Look at that. Look at how many environmental education is doing. And then the cross-cutting concepts, if you look again at each one of those, you'll see, that is environmental education is teaching that. So any science teacher is going to say if they're working on an environmental issue, they have the practices, and they have at least one-to-many cross-cutting concepts. And then the disciplinary core ideas just depends on the topic that we're talking about. Looking at it, the ones that we most probably use in environmental education are life science and earth-space sciences, but we're including more and more technology in all that. This is the third, the disciplinary core ideas. The new generation science standards are written as performance expectations. And every performance expectation has at least one practice, one concept, and one core idea written into it, every single one of them. The whole idea of the framework was to present science using these three different pieces that make science whole. But then, the performance expectations, every single one of them integrates one of the practices, one of the cross-cutting concepts, and one of the core ideas. Okay, so when we are looking at new generation science standards, we're looking at this. It's just gotten more specific, and that's what the writers did. Many of us had an opportunity to look at them and review them when they were first put out in the springtime, and many people put feedback in, and a lot of us, by the way, downloaded them really fast so that we could take a look at them and study them, okay, and I have that. That's not part of what we're doing today. But a number of us have downloaded those draft copies, and they will be going out again. Gary, do you know?
In the fall.
In the fall, and again, that's a trial. Again, it's a balloon out there. Take a look at them, review them, and then I think beginning of 2013. But that's sort of where I saw this immediately. Now, we talked a lot about stewardship in action. yesterday. And if you look at, and you go to the index on the framework, you're not going to see stewardship in there. You're not going to see action in there. Those are words that are not going to show up specifically in there. However, I would point you to, and these are differences, and Bora and I talked about this yesterday, if you look at Earth and Space Sciences, there's a third one there that we have not seen before when we had the benchmarks and all that, and that's Earth and Human Activity. So immediately, there's a walk in place. Now, that immediately brings in, you know, pieces that you can start moving in that direction. All right, then we have on top of that, I'm going to step into the Common Core piece and talk about the disciplinary literacy. Disciplinary literacy will now be a huge focus at all levels, but more and more in middle and high school. By high school, students are supposed to be doing 75% of their reading will be in the content areas. That's huge. Learning how to read, how to read science. Many of you are science or social studies people. Were you taught specifically how to read your particular content area? Oh, well, you just did it by trial and error, and you read that same biochemistry paragraph 18 times until you got the information out of it. Okay, no one ever taught us. We just, you know, just sort of figured it out. And if you didn't figure out what probably happened, you failed, more than likely. Okay, if you didn't figure that out. Well, now we're teaching those skills. But disciplinary literacy means that teachers are going to be looking for good types of readings for students to be doing, things that they're going to be engaged in and interested in. Does the environment fit into that? Are kids interested in that kind of thing? They sure are. So again, the disciplinary literacy fits very well into next generation science students. But I want to talk a little bit more about the action piece because I found two very interesting statements in the vision. And this is one of them. This is what, again, it's right in the beginning of the vision statement. What all students should know in preparation for their individual lives and for their roles as citizens in this technology-rich and scientifically complex world. So again, that brings in roles as citizens. It goes into all the things that Bora was talking about. What is a citizen? That brings in the citizenship piece. What does it mean to be a citizen? So it's there in the vision. How it's going to be, again, we can always go back to that, but next generation science students includes this. And this one I love. Grade 12 senior, vision for a grade 12 senior straight from the framework. Engage in public discussions on science-related issues, environmental. To be critical consumers of scientific information, environmental. To continue to learn about science throughout their lives, and that's where, what probably for all of us, that's about lifelong learning. No matter what it is, the field that we're talking about, that's what we want. And so I see, again, a perfect match. By the way, my son also has a job.
I was waiting for that.
I'm not going to name the company, but it's a big electrical company in this area. Thank you. Okay.
Is the sound turned down this phone? Is that possible?
It turn it down?
No, is it down?
I thought I turned it up.
Okay. Andrea, are you on the phone?
She sent an email saying that she can't really call in with the conference line.
All right. No problem. So I'm all right, sure. We will move on and make up some time. Okay. So Jennifer.
Good morning, everybody. I was asked by Kevin just to do a quick walkthrough of what our organization, the National Environmental Education Foundation, has been doing to try to position the environment essentially as a portal for STEM learning, to really elevate the opportunity that we have to show how the environment can really inspire and engage students to use and apply STEM skills. And so I'm just going to do a quick walkthrough of what we've been up to, and I know that we are trying to serve as a platform for many of your programs and initiatives as well, so I hope we can talk about that at some point before the day is through. So for those of you who don't know, NEEF, National Environmental Education Foundation, is the sister agency to the EPA. We were established through an act of Congress in 1990 to be able to further lifelong environmental education and specifically to bring in more resources to that effort through public-private partnerships. So as one initiative that we run at a national level, in National Environmental Education Week, we really focus on supporting educators, non-formal and K-12 teachers, to integrate the environment into what they're doing in their daily work. And the week is really the week prior to Earth Day, and it's meant to showcase and highlight the great work that's happening around the country. When it was first established, there wasn't really a platform nationally to say, hey, there is a lot of fabulous work with great results happening. And so around 6-7 years ago, that was really the impetus, was to say we really need to raise the profile of the great work that everybody's doing out there. And this was one way to do it. So we have had a number of different themes over the years. We focused, for example, in 2011 on ocean connections. We had a lot of teachers coming to us saying, we want to teach about what's happened in the Gulf. Can you help us? Can you help us put together resources? Where can we go to? We partnered quite heavily with NOAA, for example, with webinars, curating resources, packaging those, and putting them together. And then last year, we had, in our position, we work quite a bit, as I mentioned, with the private sector, with companies. And we started to really realize that if you were going to try to attract resources to environmental ed in K-12, you really needed to be talking about STEM. As they are establishing their foundations and their corporate priorities in giving, they all have a pillar of sustainability now, almost all of them that we're talking with. But in many cases in education, it's all about STEM. So if you're not doing something that has something to do with sustainability and STEM, then there's really not a conversation to be had. So recognizing that, what we're trying to do is really make the case that corporations can invest resources in supporting environmental ed because it really gives students an opportunity to apply STEM skills and, as importantly, to be interested in them in the first place. So I'm sorry, I got stuck here. Okay. So just as an example, the environment is inspiration for 21st century learning. We really wanted to posit that as a compelling context for teaching STEM, providing teachers with a diverse range of real-world challenges that engage students in meaningful hands-on opportunities to apply and reinforce STEM concepts across multiple subject areas. So really, this was the first time to step out and put the gauntlet down and say, here it is, here's an opportunity for others to come to the table who may not have seen themselves in the EE world so explicitly. We developed a number of toolkits and really focused on some of the most popular environmental topics within schools today. So for example, gardens and schoolyards, energy efficiency, climate and weather, water resources, and said, here's how you can use these to teach science, technology, engineering, and math, and made that very explicit. So for example, in gardens, really pulled out how you can analyze soil samples, plotting plant growth, graphing rainfall, using engineering concepts to design greenhouses, and so on. If I could get your help to pass out your infographic. One of the things that we did to communicate with the education sector as well as the private sector was to really look at something that Lori alluded to in the punchline of her presentation with her son actually having a job at the end of the day with environmental studies, is to really recognize that the pipeline and the workforce is the main priority of investment when it comes to what the private sector is interested in, and really making the case that there is a through line between what we see here, which is really this portal for environmental education. It's sort of the bullseye or the centerpiece of the infographic that's being passed around and shared with you, to say, we know and we can prove, through research that many of you have been involved with here, that 99% of kids 6 to 11 believe that it's important to care for the environment. So that is a starting point. 92% of teens are concerned about the environment. So when we start with that, it really feels like there's sort of a reverberation here of energy. It's really ripe for coming in through this door and then looking at then how can you use that to engage students in science, in technology, in engineering, and in math. One of the stats that really speaks to me here is if you look at the 57% down here,